You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's show, from Israel to Russia, we'll review the day's top stories with Raffaella Pantucci and Daniela Pellet. Then author Alistair Bonner takes us on a journey of the world's lost spaces, invisible cities and forgotten islands, and explains what they reveal about the way we live.
I really think that we need to talk more about place and our love of place. I talk about the book as being pulled together by this idea of topophilia, in other words, the love of place.
Then we'll ask our man in Washington what's next as late night host Craig Ferguson ditches his bosses at CBS. And later in the show,
oh mother dear, oh, you don't not know.
We will review the latest music tracks with journalist Tim Chipping here in the studio. That is right here on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, starting right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Pro-Russia activists have stormed several government buildings in the eastern Ukrainian city of Luhansk. They seized the regional headquarters and the prosecutor's office. Armed men later attacked the main police station. And Kiev officials say they have information the activists are also planning to seize the local television center. Interim President Oleksandr Turchynov has criticized local police for what he calls their inaction and criminal treachery. Russia has told the United States it has no intention of invading Ukraine and expressed concern about the buildup of American and NATO forces in Eastern Europe. 600 US troops have been deployed to Poland and the Baltic countries of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, it's reported, for military exercises. And four British Typhoon fighter jets have arrived at a NATO base in Lithuania to take part in increased Baltic border patrols. Deputy Commander of the Polish troops, Lieutenant Colonel Piotr Wiremski, says his team is ready.
We expect that hard work. Just hard work, but we would like to expect also to cooperate with other military contingents, like maybe not American, but British or Danish guys and Danish soldiers.
Russia's complaint comes as the US and European Union impose more sanctions on Russian firms and individuals close to President Vladimir Putin. The EU says it's targeting politicians and military leaders, and not businessmen and companies. Ukraine's Deputy Foreign Minister Natalia Haliburenko says there's still a chance for diplomatic talks with Russia to take place.
We call on the Russian Federation to stick to the Geneva Statement. So this statement contains actually all provisions aimed at de-escalating situation. Ukraine has already made its part of the job. We expect that the Russian Federation will do the same. So there is still a possibility for sitting at the table and trying to look at the situation through diplomatic means.
Two car bombs have killed at least 37 people, including women and children, in the central Syrian city of Homs. Earlier, as many as 14 people died and more than 80 were wounded in a mortar attack on a school complex in Damascus. On Monday, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad nominated himself to seek re-election. The international community has called on him to stand down so a political solution to the civil war can be found. The search for survivors continues in southern US states that were smashed by huge tornadoes on Monday and Tuesday. The storms cut a broad swathe of destruction, leaving at least 28 people dead, flattened buildings, overturned cars, and thousands of residents without power. Severe weather is threatening as many as 73 million people in eastern states. Government forecasters have warned of severe thunderstorms from the Gulf of Mexico up to the Great Lakes. The international military air search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane off the western coast of Australia has now come to an end. Officials say they'll continue to use underwater equipment and sensors to try to find some trace of flight MH370. The plane disappeared in March with 329 people on board. The International Olympic Committee Vice President John Coates has criticised Brazil's preparations for the 2016 Olympics as the worst he's ever seen. He says the country is a long way behind schedule, but he warned there's no plan B to find another host. Mr. Coates says construction has yet to begin at some venues, with infrastructure also significantly delayed. Extra IOC monitors have been sent to follow developments. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
And Bill Bingham will be back in the studio in about 25 minutes with more news headlines. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06 and it is 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Raffaella Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the London-based Think Tank RUSI, and Daniela Pelletan, Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both to the programme.
Hey.
Let's start with Israel-Palestine and John Kerry's controversial comments. Supposedly when speaking at a closed-door meeting with Japanese and European officials on Friday, Secretary of State Kerry said that without a two-state solution, Israel was at risk of becoming an apartheid state. This comment has prompted condemnations from across the US political spectrum. And later on, Kerry said that if he could rewind the tape, he would have chosen a different word. Daniela, what is your understanding? What exactly was it that Kerry meant with this comment?
Well, first of all, he used the A word. The A word is something you try not to use if you don't want to upset Israel and supporters of Israel, because it's so overused, perhaps, by its opponents. What Kerry was saying, and it's hard to argue with this, really, is if things go on their current trajectory and there's no two-state solution, then you'll have a situation where you have an effective one-state solution where Israel is ruling over a population, some of whom do not have full citizenship. The thing is, with the apartheid allegation, people seem to think it means that in Israel, black Israelis have different rights and Arab Israelis have different rights in law. And it's not, there's no direct analogy to South Africa. But it's true. There are different levels of equality, and certainly looking into the future, if you have Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza who are effectively citizens of a country where they have no rights, then well, it's quite an apt terminology, I would think.
And at the same time, reaction has been quite significant. For example, a senator in the US has been asking for Secretary of State Kerry to resign. Do you think these remarks are going to have further consequences?
I'd point out it was a Republican senator who had made these comments, so it's not entirely surprising that he would come out with this. So, I mean, you know, I think it is the sort of political spectrum that we're seeing come out against this in the United States is very much the people we'd expect to come out against this. For me, in some ways, and I think Daniela, you know, characterized the comments and what I think he meant perfectly. But I think that in some ways for me, I wonder who leaked this tape. You know, that's what makes me wonder. This is a recording of what I believe was a private meeting. And somehow this recording got out. And so I wonder whose motivation was for doing that. Because, you know, it's clearly a very loaded term. But I don't know if he used it in a public forum. I think this was a closed door official meeting, right?
So it was a closed meeting. But I don't think he's, I think maybe it is a slight overreaction. But this is quite consistent with what things he said before. There was an awful kind of furore when he said that there was danger from the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And it was interpreted as he was threatening sanctions. He wasn't. He's pointing out a fairly uncontroversial possibility. A few people in Israel, really, even on the right. I mean, the Habayit HaYehudi head, Naftali Bennett, is talking about annexing a large swathe of the West Bank. This, the right in Israel call it the demographic threat in the West Bank. This is nothing new.
As you pointed out there, this was indeed a closed meeting and nothing was supposed to be leaked outside. Do you think there has been even more of this kind of language being used behind the scenes?
I think the language used behind the scenes is even more robust.
Yeah.
I mean, look where we are. In 2014, the two-state solution is fading ever faster into the distance, and neither side is looking for any kind of permanent state solution. Both sides are playing to their own constituency, their own domestic political constituency, and it's very much a holding pattern. Both sides in a holding pattern. The Palestinians, I have to say, are edging ahead in the diplomatic war with a sequence of really quite clever moves, which are leaving the Israelis floundering somewhat.
Do you think this controversy, at least on one side of the US political spectrum and internationally, could even lead into something good?
It seems that the US are trying, as patronising it sounds, to save Israel from itself. I mean, the US are Israel's greatest friends, long-term allies. It would be very hard to imagine it, describing them as enemies of Israel. Kerry has put an immense amount of effort into this peace initiative. Mm. Talking to Netanyahu every day, apparently, and Netanyahu has never been much of a favourite in successive White House administrations. And he's about to walk away. The US has said, right, we're taking a step back. There's nothing we can do. There's very little more they can do without both sides wanting to take the initiative.
The deadline set by the US for peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians has indeed ended without an agreement being reached. And just today, Israeli forces were reported having demolished several structures, including a mosque in a Palestinian village. The situation is obviously frustrating. Where to from here, then?
Where to? Well, nowhere, really. As far as the Israelis are concerned, they're just going to keep on keeping on. The status quo. The Israelis famously, and quite cliche, are very good at tactics. They call it in Hebrew improvisatia. They're not so good at strategy. The Palestinians have got a very clear deadline. That's the General Assembly in United Nations in New York this autumn. They're going to carry on pushing for unilateral declaration of statehood, membership of international organisations, access to the International Criminal Court, and fighting, as I said, a clever and completely non-violent and completely legal battle for independence.
I wonder what you think the implications would be if this, of nothing really proceeding for the Obama administration. Because as you point out, they've really put a lot, the US has invested a lot into trying to resolve the situation. Kerry has personally engaged in it a lot. Obama's even sort of expressed some sort of an interest in it. I mean, what happens if, in fact, we get towards the end of Obama administration and there has been no movement?
Well, look, movement on Israel-Palestine is a great bonus for American administration, but it's also no great shame if you don't manage it, because that is the rule rather than the exception. And they can say, we tried. I mean, you know, Kerry has got an awful lot of...
But so many administrations have tried, you know.
But he's got an awful lot more pressing foreign policy crises to deal with now than this old chestnut, which just keeps on keeping on.
Well, let's leave Israel and Palestine now. Let's head to Egypt and let's talk about yet another show trial for hundreds of Muslim Brotherhood members. An Egyptian court has recommended the death penalty for 683 individuals, all affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. This trial lasted just minutes. Most of the accused were tried in absentia and the judge refused to hear witnesses. First reactions from you.
Well, this is the second time we've seen this, right? I mean, just recently there was another one where 529 people were similarly speedily tried and, in fact, sentenced to death. But then I understand that apparently only 37 of those sentences were actually upheld. How many of them actually carried out is the next question.
Yeah, they only got life or 25 years in prison.
Right.
So that's...
Right. No, I mean, I don't think an improvement, life over a death sentence. But, I mean, it sounds very dramatic to say we're going to execute 683 people. It's another thing to execute a smaller amount. I mean, the thing I think about Egypt is that... And especially this crackdown that they're having in the Muslim Brotherhood, is I worry about what the implications of it are and what the consequences of it will be. We've already got a sort of simmering insurgency in the Sinai, and we've already got some pretty hardline Islamist groups out there that have been able to launch increasingly substantial terrorist attacks around the country. And if we look back at history, and we look back when Anwar Sadat was killed, and we look at what happened then to the crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, and in some ways that was what created some of the Egyptian elements that went on to become quite significant within Al-Qaeda. Could we see a similar thing happen here when we see the government really stamping down so heavy on the Muslim Brotherhood, arresting, you know, Now we're talking about 1,000 or more of them being put, you know, on death sentences. What happens to the group then if they see that there is no political avenue for them to pursue? Some of them may continue to, you know, think, well, there's a long-term political goal we want to fight out. But some of them will surely fracture off and start to see that maybe violence is the only solution, especially when they see that the alternative is that they were going to get executed by the government.
No, I think you're right. I think the Sinai crisis is crucial in this, in terms of also international support. Yeah. The Americans, having said repeatedly, we want to see progress towards democracy, have just renewed some of their military aid to Egypt. They say, well, this is because of the situation in Sinai. And they're right. Yeah. The situation in Sinai is crucial for Israel, for international stability and regional stability. But the current administration in Egypt are really doing exactly what they want. Yeah. And what is also alarming, not just their moves against the Muslim Brotherhood, they also outlawed the April 6 movement, which was so active in the original process. They're saying, we can do what we want.
Exactly. And also about these latest news of these latest 683 individuals who have basically got the death penalty. One of them is beloved Muslim Brotherhood spiritual leader Muhammad Badi. What happens if he is put to death?
I mean, I think we've seen historically whenever individuals like this are executed, what tends to happen is, you know, networks within the sort of broader terrorist groups will show up using that name and will try to avenge him. I mean, it's been happened repeatedly. Ahmed Sheikh Yassin in Palestine, there are, I don't know how many brigades named after him, the Abdullah Azzam brigades. I mean, you can go down the list. These guys, it has the effect of radicalizing the community more because it just says to them, well, there's no other solution. This is what they're going to do. They're going to execute your great leaders in this horrible way. And, you know, what are you going to do about it? And the answer is violence.
I'm trying to do my maths over here, and I counted that so far 1,200, 1,300 people have been indeed sentenced to death. Can the rest of the world just look at this from a side and not react?
Well, I think as ever, the rest of the world wants to choose stability over, you know, great concepts of truth and justice and so on. We've got elections coming up. There aren't really very many candidates with any. Sisi is gonna win. I don't see the international community. I see them making noises, and I see the reliable NGOs making the appropriate noises as well. But the fear of what could happen if there wasn't a strong regime in Egypt, I think that's pretty frightening.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's the question of instability in Egypt across the entire country is very, very worrying, especially if it's led by some sort of chaotic Muslim group. But I think the other longer term consequence is that I don't know if we're going to see the impact of yet is the fact of what does it mean that we had a country like Egypt, which voted, even under what was a flawed election, a Muslim Brotherhood government in, which was only given a year. And admittedly, it was not a perfect government and they had all sorts of problems. They didn't really resolve the economic issues that they maybe should have focused on. Was, you know, defenestrated and then promptly banned, prescribed as a terrorist organization, individuals mass arrested and, you know, death sentenced by thousands. You know, the long-term consequences of that are the perception that Muslim groups are not going to be allowed to enter into the political process and win. And what does that mean? And what does that mean when we're talking about these sort of bigger trends of Muslim political movements around the world? If they look at this and they say, well, the international community is willing to stand by while a group that was legally elected is removed in this way.
With Hamas as well. I mean, this seems to be a pattern. But also, what does it mean for the future and the rehabilitation of Egypt? Does Egypt ever want to get any of its tourist bags? Ever want to rebuild its international image? Arresting journalists, holding them in detention, mass trials. This doesn't bode well for any kind of revival of the Egyptian economy.
And we've even had attacks on tourists. You know, this which was sort of the very great Rubicon that the groups did tend to avoid, you know, because there was such perception that it was such an important element. You know, the deaths of those, I think it was South Korean tourists in the Sinai a while ago, that was something that we really hadn't seen a huge amount before. Now, if that continues, then you're right. Another aspect of the Egyptian economy will evaporate.
Let's continue with a short break now. Raffaello and Daniela will be still here in the studio when we return. And up next, we look at Russia and China.
On this week's edition of The Foreign Desk, we head to Africa to ask the liberation question.
It was across ethnic lines, across class lines, across religious lines, and they all came together in this broad alliance.
As South Africa prepares to vote in an election that the ANC will win outright, we'll ask why liberation movements that came to power decades ago have rarely been voted out.
You know, I thought that old thing, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, was just one of those phrases. But I think in the last few years, it's been proved true time and time again.
From Zimbabwe to South Africa, Namibia to Somaliland, we'll assess how liberation movements across Africa have fared so differently as they transition from rebels to the holders of power.
In some ways, Somaliland has got the most democratic, fair political system in the whole of East and the Horn of Africa.
That's the liberation question, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24. The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world. Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It is 2021 in Helsinki, 18:21 in London and 13:21 in New York City. Still with me is Raffaella Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI, and Daniela Pellet, and Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Let's turn now to the crisis in eastern Ukraine and the debate over how to punish President Vladimir Putin's inner circle. Yesterday, the US announced new sanctions targeting seven Russian individuals and 17 companies, while today the European Union published a list of 15 individuals facing travel bans and asset freezes. Do you think this is going to make a difference, Daniela?
Well, the short answer is no. The first round of sanctions were quite shocking because they seemed to target, as you said, Putin's inner circle, making a strong point. This round of sanctions focusing more on people who are involved in, allegedly, in eastern Ukraine, the chief of the Russian general staff, the head of military intelligence, and people who until now were barely heard of, the people who are far more involved in eastern Ukraine. The problem is the European Union and America really has to stop very short of a trade war. Because what if it damages Russia too much? It will damage itself. And so far, the Russian stock market has seemed to be fairly buoyant in the face of these new sanctions. They could have been an awful lot worse.
On today's news, just recently, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister said that Russia had no intention of invading eastern Ukraine. Another recent news story says that pro-Russia activists have seized several official buildings in the eastern Ukrainian city of Luhansk. What is your impression? How much power does Russia actually have over what's going on in eastern Ukraine at the moment?
I think it probably has quite a lot of power if it wanted to exert it. I think that we are clearly dealing with a situation where Russia has got proxies of some sort or some sort of influence or power they could exert in this situation. I think, I was going to say, Daniela said that this really isn't changing. I think this is going to really pee Putin off, frankly speaking. I think these specific sanctions, and specifically the American ones, which are really targeting the community around him even more, including people who purportedly are maybe looking after assets for him, for his sort of future. I think it's clearly going to really anger him, and I think it will make relations between the United States and Russia very complicated. I think the European Union seems to be targeting it a bit more at the sort of Ukraine and what's happening on the ground, and that maybe puts it in a slightly different context. But I think certainly the American ones are going to really anger Putin, and who knows what the repercussions of that would be. I think, do the Russians have power in this situation? Yes, I think they do. I'm sure they do, in fact. And I think this is very much a situation where they have seen an opportunity and they've decided to push as hard as they can. I think we're beginning to see the end of how far they're going to push, though, because I don't think that even Putin's administration wants to go to war.
At the same time, it seems that the Russia-US relations are getting ever tenser. Russia has been talking about an unprecedented NATO military build-up on its borders, whereas NATO is insisting that its deployments are there just to reassure worried members. Are we seeing some kind of an information war over here at the same time?
Well, I mean, the NATO troops, there's a few hundred troops. We're talking about thousands of Russian troops accidentally just doing, they're just practicing somewhere near eastern Ukraine. Of course. I mean, they're talking about, they described it as the new Cold War, which I think was a phrase originally coined by Churchill. It's not quite.
Was it Iron Curtain that he coined, right? The sort of there's an Iron Curtain going across Europe, which we're now seeing happen all over again.
Yeah, but in terms of the information war, the Russian media is targeted at the Russian speaking population. I think in eastern Ukraine, certainly in Crimea, people are already less supportive than they were of Russia, certainly in Crimea. Very quickly, people have already seen that far from offering this new economic miracle, it's the opposite. Crimea is destined for some very, very hard times. Most of its economy is based on tourism. Most of its tourists come from Ukraine. They're not going to be heading there anytime soon. And also in eastern Ukraine, this is going a bit too far. I've spoken to many people on the ground who say, despite the links with Russia, despite speaking Russian, this is not what they had in mind at all.
So when we think of how this conflict could be resolved, I guess no one really thinks that there is a way for Crimea to be returned to be a part of Ukraine anymore. But when we look at what's going on in eastern Ukraine, should Russia now do something? Would that be the way of easing these tensions? Or what is going to bring an end to all this?
It's very hard to tell, because at each stage, I think we've thought, okay, this is it. No further. No, really. I mean, even Crimea. Why really would Russia want that? Why would Russia? It's a financial, it's an economic burden. And to be honest, Kiev probably quite glad to get rid of it in terms of the number of pro-Russian voters that were there. And then you think, well, they're not going to continue into eastern Ukraine. This ramping up, this kidnapping, the abuse of journalists. But I don't think there's a 5-year plan for this. I think Russia is feeling its way still and seeing how much opposition it comes across and what will be cost and benefit at each stage. But we're very far from the end of the crisis, very far.
Let's leave Ukraine and Russia for now. Let's move to China, where the country's president has reiterated that the western region of Xinjiang is on the front line of terrorism. Rafael, you study this region. Is this anything new from Xi Jinping?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it's the first time we've seen Xi Jinping go out to the province since he's become the leader. And it's a province that has had many, many really horrible attacks since he's been in power. Lots of clashes between local Uyghur minority ethnic community that are in the province that chafe against what they perceive as an external rule from Beijing that's sort of taking their land. And we've seen, hundreds of people die in these sorts of clashes. And then we saw earlier this year an incident in Kunming where a group of Uyghurs attacked Han Chinese passengers who were waiting for the train at the train station there. And, Xi Jinping visiting out there, I think this is an acknowledgement of the fact that the problems in the province are really quite serious. And I think he's sort of going out there is really trying to put his imprimatur and support behind the effort that's being done out there. Now, the reporting that seems to have come out seems very much focused on him talking about the province as the front line in terrorism, and specifically the city of Kashgar, which is the sort of furthest western city in the province. And he spent his time, visiting lots of police, and he came up some wonderful phrases: sweat more in peacetime to bleed less in wartime, which is a wonderfully sort of bellicose turn of phrase that the Chinese administration likes to use. But I think, broadly, this is what's happening in the province is something that has only been getting worse recently. And I think that his visit out there is in part acknowledgement of this, because it's a big deal when the leader goes out there for these sorts of public visits. But it's also, I think, because there's a recognition that something new does need to be done. And I think that's what they're currently really trying to work out.
I think what struck me about the coverage of the visit was perhaps a slightly clumsy way that he seemed to be fighting for hearts and minds as well, wearing a traditional hat, talking to children about how important it was to be bilingual. I mean, there's also previous reports from the region talking about local people being paid to inform if their neighbour is growing too long a beard. Yeah. I mean, this is as I said, it's a very sort of clumsy, broad brush way to deal with a very, very complex situation, not something that the Chinese are very used to dealing with.
No, they're not. But I think the point about Xinjiang is, and the fact that we've seen the incident, because there was the incident last October in Tiananmen Square, which was linked to the province in some way, shape or form. There was the incident in Kunming, where we saw it. The problem is that the problems in Xinjiang are no longer just reserved to the province, which is where they used to be. And the administration kind of say, OK, well, that happens out west. It's now happening around the country. And I think that's why I think you're 100% right that, you know, is this really going to be the solution? I don't know. By the same light of seeing him put on the little Uyghur hat, which is one shot. In the next shot, I think we saw him visiting the police station and seeing all the batons and sticks that they were using to sort of put down protests.
It's a very subtle media message.
It is. You know, it's a very sophisticated soft power message they're advancing.
We have to leave this discussion to these images, unfortunately, already. Raffaella Panducci from RUSI and Daniela Pellet from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
There is plenty more to come on the second half of today's edition of Midori House. We'll check in with our man in Washington. We go off the map with Alistair Bonnet and we review some new tracks with music journalist Tim Chipping. But before we get started on all that, here is Bill Bingham with the World News Headlines.
Pro-Russia activists have stormed several government buildings in the eastern Ukrainian city of Luhansk. They seized the regional headquarters and the prosecutor's office. Armed men later attacked the main police station. Russia has told the United States it has no intention of invading Ukraine and expressed concern about the build-up of American and NATO forces in eastern Europe. Two car bombs have killed at least 37 people, including women and children, in the central Syrian city of Homs. Earlier, as many as 14 people died and more than 80 were wounded in a mortar attack on a school complex in Damascus. The search for survivors continues in southern U.S. states that were smashed by huge tornadoes on Monday and Tuesday. The storms cut a broad swathe of destruction, leaving at least 28 people dead, flattened buildings, overturned cars, and thousands of residents without power. Severe weather is threatening as many as 73 million people in eastern states. The international military air search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane off the western coast of Australia has now come to an end. Officials say they'll continue to use underwater equipment and sensors to try to find some trace of flight MH370. The International Olympic Committee Vice President John Coates has criticised Brazil's preparations for the 2016 Olympics as the worst he's ever seen. He says the country's a long way behind schedule, but he warned there's no plan B to find another host. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to the US, where joining me is Monocle's Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha, welcome to the program. Shall we start by talking about a person who ran Afghan intelligence operations in Kandahar 10 years ago, who has all of a sudden appeared in Southern California? What is that?
Yeah, pretty remarkable story. The Washington Post found this fellow, Gula Lai, who was the head of the NSD, the National Security Directorate in Afghanistan, and was described as the country's torturer-in-chief and seemed to, as a result, antagonize folks on both sides. The Taliban wasn't terribly fond of him. Karzai's government was suspicious of him, and the U.S. thought that he was a bit of a problem from a sort of human rights and good governance perspective. The Washington Post found him living in what they described as a two-story pink stucco house in a Southern California suburb, and sort of wonderful piece trying to disentangle how exactly he got into the U.S., who may have helped him, and whether or not he did so legally and belongs here. The refugee laws in the United States prohibit people who sort of have been accused or perpetrated atrocities, and the question is whether U.S. officials may have sort of glossed over that in trying to get him out of Afghanistan and into a quiet life somewhere else.
So, Sasha, how much is known of this background at the moment? How on earth did he find his way and get to Southern California?
So we know from the Post reporting that he was in an immigration hearing in a court where he appeared to sort of play on some confusion over the fact that he's lived under two different names, one of a sort of, I think, tribal clan name and one a more official name. And so he did get his refugee status sort of heard by a judge and had it approved. It's not at all clear how exactly he got out of Kabul, most likely into Los Angeles. There are provisions that allow the U.S. government to sort of expedite people who are in dire circumstances where they're at risk. But even when you arrive at the U.S., you then have to apply for asylum. And, you know, based on how we understand the rules for asylum, somebody who, you know, was running torture programs and accused of human rights violations would probably be a weak candidate.
And this is a very sensitive topic, considering that there is a substantial number of Afghans who have been trying to get to the US but haven't been able to do that due to obvious immigration barriers. And at the same time, these very same people are worried for their own safety because they could be potential targets of the Taliban.
Yeah, and this is something that the US, you know, even as the US has pulled out of Iraq and pulled out of Afghanistan, you know, one of the ongoing issues that the U.S. will deal with is all sorts of sort of resettlement issues. People who, on one hand, I mean, unlike this guy, Gul Ali, who worked in good faith with the U.S., either military or private contractors who want to come to the U.S. and feel that they're being threatened if they stay in Iraq or Afghanistan, and how much the U.S. is willing to open up its immigration and refugee laws to account for what in both countries appears to be a really large demand for the ability to live in the United States is, I think, a question that we'll probably be seeing Americans dealing with for a while, and possibly seeing the recriminations back in those countries for people who ended up having to stay.
Sasha, let's leave Afghanistan for a while. Let's continue by talking about basketball in the U.S. and racism controversy surrounding it.
Yeah, Don Sterling, who is the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, has been a controversial figure to the extent that anybody paid attention to the Clippers for the 30 years that he's owned the team. They are considered one of the absolute worst franchises in American sports, and the only thing that keeps him as the owner of a professional basketball team is that we don't have relegation here in our leagues. But he was caught on tape this weekend saying to a girlfriend who is currently ensnared in a civil case against him some rather vile racist things, basically that he didn't want her to bring black people to Clippers games, that he didn't want her to be seen cavorting with black people, including Magic Johnson, one of the sort of most celebrated basketball players ever. And this has in 3 days turned into a big national scandal. The NBA is being forced to respond today, and they don't have a lot of great tools at their disposal, which is he owns a business, and it's not entirely clear, as much as the NBA and the fellow owners would love to get him to sell, whether they can actually legally compel him to do so. But the NBA is a largely black league in terms of players, and has a sort of large black audience in the United States, and aside from whatever the sort of moral grievances are, they have a bit of a marketing problem that they don't look like they've aggressively pushed back.
Sasha, let's finish by talking about what's going on television in the US. The Scottish-born host of CBS's The Late Late Show, Craig Ferguson, has just announced, well, to his studio audience during Monday's taping of his show, that he will leave in December when his current contract expires. Are you disappointed by this news?
I'm rarely up looking for something to watch on TV at 12:30 a.m. He's found a very devoted niche audience and is thought to be particularly innovative, I think, in the form. For CBS and for late night in general, this is a sort of an interesting moment, because it was just 2 weeks or so ago that David Letterman announced that he'd be leading The Late Show, which is the show that leads in. Stephen Colbert will be moving from Comedy Central to fill that slot. Now CBS has another issue to deal with, and just in the last couple of years, both of NBC's late-night slots have turned over as Jay Leno has retired. And so, you know, there's a sort of musical chairs moment of hosts moving around, but I think also people are trying to figure out what exactly the role of these shows is in an era where people are not watching live TV, and there's much less of a sense of sort of, you know, occasion viewing that exists when Johnny Carson was sort of the most beloved television figure in America.
Interesting times on television indeed. That was Monaco's Washington correspondent Sash Eisenberg there. Thank you very much. You are listening to Midori House on Monaco 24. Up next we'll go off the map. Stay tuned.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monaco 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monaco 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monaco 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. Have we mapped it all? In the world of Google Earth, it would be easy to think so, but Alistair Bonnet, a professor of social geography at Newcastle University, disagrees. In his new book, Off the Map, Bonnet reviews places and non-places we never thought about. It goes from the mundane, like a traffic island in Newcastle, to more unusual spaces like urban labyrinths, borderlands, enclaves, or what we've come to call the Pacific Trash Vortex, a sea of ocean-borne trash said to be the size of Texas. To find out more about those lost spaces, Monaco producer Daphne Denis spoke to Alistair just a bit earlier.
It's a book that I think will surprise people and extend their ideas about what geography does. It's a book of hidden, alarming, amazing places, places that make us think about our relationship to place and the possibilities of place.
You've divided your book between lost spaces, invisible cities, forgotten islands and feral places. Can you explain that divide?
What I wanted was places that would amaze people. And I searched the world for places that fulfilled that function. Unheard of places, ones that are very much off the map in terms of people's ordinary geographical imagination. And I wanted to move in the book from the more natural and the more kind of places that one just might just come across in the course of journeying around the world to places that are more man-made or humanly constructed. So the places towards the end of the book are ones which people have endeavored to construct. And the last place I have in the book is, in fact, it's about children's places. And I go back to the dens that me and my brother used to make when we were children. And I do that in order to talk about the very special relationship between children and place, because if there's one kind of a place which is often unhidden, often undiscussed, and very much off the map, it's the intimate little and hidden places of children.
While you were doing your research, is there a specific spot, a place that really amazed you and surprised you?
Well, they all did. There's 47 places in this book, and they're only in there because I found them jaw-dropping. Sometimes they are jaw-dropping because they're just so startling and enormous in their scale, such as the deserted cities that I cover in the book. The cities that have been deserted because of conflict or just because they were built and no one ever moved into them. But I do go from the exotic to the very ordinary, and I try and connect these scales. So I have places such as there's a traffic island which I walk past every day to work. It's not so much a traffic island, I suppose, as a place abandoned in the middle of the city because there are huge roads going on all three sides of this island, so it's completely unreachable. And I thought, what an extraordinary, strange, deserted island in the middle of the city. So I tried to research that place and found that it was never planned. The roads were planned around the island, but this place, which is now covered in scrub and little trees, was never planned. It's just one of the many odd places that are kind of in between places that were planned that we all walk past every day. And once you start noticing one, you notice many. And we're surrounded by these very odd little geographical eruptions in the middle of the city, ones that were never planned but are still there.
As you say, you go from the ordinary to sort of the bigger picture. You talk about borders, you talk about enclaves. What is it exactly that you were trying to say? What's the sort of common denominator in that book?
Well, the common denominator is humans' love of place. I really think that we need to talk more about place and our love of place. I talk about the book as being pulled together by this idea of topophilia, in other words, the love of place. And I think for too long we've talked about architecture, we've talked about culture and literature and all sorts of different social and cultural forms, but we're not very good at talking about place and our need for it, our love of it. And I think what has happened is that we've therefore been very casual in our relationship to place, and many of us only have to look outside our window to see the results in terms of places which are constantly being pulled apart with very little consideration, it seems, for the very deep bonds that many of us have with the places around us. So the book is, in a way, a tribute to the very human love of place. And you go to and talk about all these extraordinary places in order to talk about different aspects of our care and love of place.
And finally, you announce, even on the cover of the book, that you're going to explain what those places tell us about the world. So far, you've only answered what they tell us about ourselves and our love of place. But what did you find out about the world when you were writing that book?
Well, what the book tells us is that the world is still worth exploring. It is often said that, and in geography, since I work in the geography department and a professor of geography, that it's often said that the world is completely known, that the age of exploration is very much behind us. It was said even in the end of the 19th century that there is nowhere left to explore. But I don't think this is a very happy conclusion, and I don't think it's a very accurate one. The book shows that the world is still full of unexplored and extraordinary places, and they can be thousands of miles away, or they can be right around the corner.
That was Alistair Bonnet, author of Off the Map with Monocle's Daphne Dunne. It's time now for a bit of music here on Midori House. In a moment, we'll review some music tracks with music journalist Tim Chipping. Taking us there is a song of Tim's choice. This is From the Campbells. Let's have a listen. That was indeed music by the Campbells, and you'll hear the name of the song in just a second. Before the name, I will introduce you our guest. Music journalist Tim Chipping is here in the studio to review some new music tracks for us. And indeed, what was the name of that song?
I'm not even going to attempt it. I just call that, it's a set of Pertabil, it's mouth music. I wouldn't even dare speak Gaelic because I know so many Gaelic people who would just cringe in horror at my pronunciation.
In principle, if I tried to pronounce it, it would be something like Naboraik.
It sounds nicer when you do it.
Anyway, what's the song? What's the story behind that song?
Well, the Campbells are they're three generations of the same family from a very small crofting township on the Isle of Skye. They don't have the town, have the croft now, but they do go back there regularly. And that song or those set of mouth music is from their community. It's the songs that the working people would have sung and danced to. It's very much music to dance to.
Music from Scotland with amazing history and amazing roots. How popular are the Campbells internationally? And do you think there is a big market for them to take over?
Well, they don't perform a lot, but they recently played at the LSO St Luke's in London and it was sold out, which is quite impressive for Gaelic music in London.
Exactly. And how much more do you know? You said that this music is indeed old and there are three generations over there playing. So when was the first time you discovered the Campbells and what was your first encounter with this kind of music?
I'm quite new to hearing the Campbells, but I was aware of Mary Ann Kennedy, the broadcaster, who's a member of the Campbells, which some people may have heard her radio shows. But I've been listening to lots of Gaelic music over the last few years. Julie Fowlis, I'm a big fan of. But it's not something that you hear a lot, you know, down here. It's very much kind of a difficult thing to get into. You know, you're listening to music in a language that we can't sort of begin to understand. It's a whole different culture. So, you know, it's getting there, but it's going to be a long, long time before it's kind of very, very popular. We hope it will be.
So, Tim, you have brought four tracks all together with you. Is there some kind of a common nominator?
A little bit. This is all traditional music. Apart from this, I chose all English traditional music. Some field recordings and something very, very new.
Shall we continue now? This is Died for Love by Martin and Eloisa Carthy. Let's have a listen.
It was early, early on a sunny day in spring, my love has very far upon the deep.
Martin and Eliza Carthy there, Died for Love was the name of that song. And have I understood correctly, did we just move from Scotland to England?
We did. This is as English as you could get in terms of traditional music, because this is really the, I know they'd cringe at the term, but the first family of English folk music.
What do you mean by that?
In that, well, we had originally the Watersons, who were one of the most important forces in the folk revival. And Martin Carthy similarly, and here he is with his daughter. They've never made an album together as a duo. Eliza's sung with Watson Carthy for 20 years now, but this is the first time father and daughter on album together. And it's there's so many anniversaries with this, because it's 20 years since Watson Carthy, it's nearly 50 years since Martin Carthy's first album, and 75 years of Topic Records, which is the label they've always recorded for, and what this is released on, the oldest independent record label in the world.
And when we are talking about this music, I think it's worthwhile that Eliza Carthy has actually been doing quite well. She's been nominated for the Mercury Music Prize two times.
Mm-hmm, she has. Eliza's an extraordinary, extraordinary artist, really. She can do so much, and she brings so much kind of soul and passion and energy to traditional music. I think there are probably countless people out there who play fiddle and play or sing, or form groups because they saw Eliza when they were young. She's, you know, I think her importance can't be overestimated.
We still have two songs left, and before we start talking about them, I'd like to hear your views on, when you talk about traditional music, how much does traditional music develop nowadays? What is the evolution like?
I think the evolution is fast, and it always was. I think when you listen to a song like that, Died for Love, that was the first ever commercially released folk song. That was released in 1908 on a wax cylinder. And even when you heard it then, that singer wouldn't have sounded how perhaps the singer who he learned it from. Everything changes and it develops within your own voice because it's an oral tradition. And so how you hear Died for Love now, sung by Martin and Eliza, won't be how you hear it next time it's recorded, because everyone brings their own experience and their own, and outside influences are really important too.
London town, where I came from. Well, the butcher boy, oh, mother dear, oh, you don't not know what pain.
That was indeed music from Scotland, from Glasgow. And I got so excited, Tim, that I actually claimed that this was music by The Butcher Boy, but that was the name of the song.
Yes. That particular recording, that's Queen Caroline Hughes, a fantastic traveller singer, recorded in 1962. Close to my heart, because it was actually recorded on a piece of ground called Camford Heath, which is right next to where I grew up.
Mm. And how much more can you tell about Queen Caroline Hughes? What's the background?
She is one of the most kind of sort of passionate and soulful of the Traveller Singers. Comes from a huge family. All of her kind of mother and grandfather, grandmother lived to a great old age. But she was recorded by Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger. And that's from a new release that's released all of their recordings of her songs. And she knew a colossal amount of traditional songs and some songs that seem to be unique to her that we've never been able to find other versions anywhere else.
Amazing. You know, before we run out of time, we still have one song to talk about. So this is Wicked Richardson, and the name of the track is Fagin the Cobbler.
To me wag Paul the Riddle, old lady. To me wag Paul the Riddle. To me wag Paul the Riddle, old lady.
Order, please.
That sounds amazing. Tim, what's going on over there?
Well, that's from a new CD released again by Topic called The Barley Mow. I realise I should have actually played the song The Barley Mow because the pub of that name is right next door to the studio.
What a coincidence.
But that was recorded in the Blaxall Ship pub in Suffolk in 1953 by Peter Kennedy. And if you buy that CD, there's actually a DVD or film of Wicketts singing that. And it's fantastic because he takes off both his shoes and he uses one as the shoe he's cobbling and the other one as the hammer. And there were these really elaborate mimes that he does along with it, and then everyone else in the pub knows the song so well that they all join in with the chorus.
Okay.
Which is a pub you can still go to. It's still
I was
open.
Just going to ask if the place is still there.
It is still there. So they don't sing there apparently anymore, but you can see some dancing in East Anglia still, I'm told.
Amazing, and if in England, you can indeed go there for a drink. Thank you very much for this music review. That was Tim Chipping reviewing all that music for us. Thank you very much indeed. And at the same time, this is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guest is Rafaela Pantani from Russia and Daniela Pellet, an editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and obviously also to Tim Chipping. Today's show is produced by Daniel Ciacopelli, researched by Alexa Firmanish and Sarah Furnia, and our studio manager was Joel Church. Next, after the headlines, is our weekly design show section D, so stay tuned for that. And then, of course, at 2200 hours London time, in 3 hours, it is time for the Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time, but for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.